The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for October 7th, 2017. This week, I have three very diverse and fascinating conversations to offer you. First up is Sam Gwynn. Sam is a well-known writer and historian, was tapped by Outside Magazine to research and pen a new article about Lance Armstrong for the 40th edition of Outside. Titled The Road Goes On Forever and the Story Never Ends, Sam looks at Lance today and asks the questions that everyone wants answered. Is he truly sorry? Is he going to make amends? Or is he still the same old Lance? We'll find out what Sam has to say in a moment. After a break, we're going to talk with Professor Jason Gill. Dr. Gill is a researcher in Glasgow, Scotland, where he studies cardiometabolic health. And he'll explain just how a short commute on your bike can reduce your risk of heart disease, cancer, and death. His study involved almost 250,000 people from the UK Biobank. Then I'm going to welcome Sue Knott back to the Outspoken Cyclist. When we last spoke, she had just launched a Kickstarter project to fund her bike shifter. You might remember that. But there is so much more to Sue that is uncovered in her new book, Bike Hunt. The bike hunt is the mechanism that weaves the story together, and it is fascinating. Starting in her early childhood, this amazing woman has been, seen, and done so many things, from her early advocacy for animals to the exhaustive work she did with the Thunderhead Alliance. So it's off to Austin, Texas to speak with Sam Gwynn about his article on Lance Armstrong. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, your recent article in Outside, The Road Goes On Forever and the Story Never Ends, is probably the most talked about subject on my Facebook page in a very long time. We have almost 14,000 people who are engaged in it right now, and that's unheard of for the little outspoken cyclist here.
You know, it's astonishing, isn't it, really, when you think about the ability of Lance to be not only in the public eye, but just to be controversial and to generate opinions. And the guy's been doing this for so long. It's just astounding.
And generate opinions he does. Oh, my goodness. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on the story, how you came to write it, and then we'll kind of jump into it.
How I came to write it is this. I have the magazine that it's in is Outside. And Outside is sort of the big background is that, you know, Lance Armstrong was in a lot of ways everything that Outside wanted to be. He embodied the ethic of Outside magazine. And so for all of those years when he was doing well, they covered him. They put him on the cover. I mean, it was logical. Lance was Outside magazine. He was exactly what they wanted. So, and then, of course, when things went bad for him, Outside also covered that, also just as thoroughly. And so come to the present tense, it was the Outside's 40th anniversary, and they wanted to do something interesting. They wanted to do a story about Lance. And I have written for them before, but not on anything like cycling. But one of the reasons they thought of me was they wanted somebody. I'm mainly known as the historian, you know, of the 19th century, and I've got absolutely nothing to do with cycling. I have no baggage. I never met Betsy Andreu. I don't know these people. You know, I don't have the baggage. Oh, and I wasn't like, you know, Rick Riley or Sally Jenkins burned rotten by Lance Armstrong. None of the baggage was there. So I think the theory was, hey, let's see if Sam would be interested. Lance lives in my town of Austin. I didn't know him, but would be interested, specifically because I wasn't coming in loaded up with baggage. I was just like everybody else, a consumer of the Lance stories, which I think in retrospect was probably a pretty good move. I didn't lack bias because of any virtue in me. I just didn't know anything about it.
So you're not a hardcore cyclist?
No. I mean, you know, I like everybody else. I was glued to the, you know, when Lance was winning, we were, especially here in Austin, people were just flipped over this guy, and coverage all the time, and we all watched it obsessively. So to that extent, yes. But no, otherwise, I'm not a guy who gets up there and rides for 50 miles, no.
So I take it then, when you delved into this story, you were pretty quickly became aware of these two camps, the I can't stand him, you know, he's a liar, and I'm sure there are a lot of other expletives we can't use on the air. And then there's right. The camp that says, all right, already, just let it go. And
right. And
so what do you hear about these two perspectives? You didn't really take one or the other, but it's a little more on the side of, you know, is he really a changed man?
Right. And I think maybe that's the question everybody wants to know is he really, truly sorry? Does he really, truly mean, because he says that he is now, right? But does he really mean that? And that's what people want to know. Because after all, you know, if we look back now with a little bit of distance on history, I mean, if we're going to say that Lance was a liar and a doper and a cheater, okay, let's say those three things. I can just give you the world's longest list of everybody else who was too, most of whom were on the podium, you know. So it isn't for that so much, I think, that we hold Lance responsible or that we can't forgive him. It's for the other stuff. It's for the absolute running roughshod over everybody, destroying careers, suing people, doing all the things that he did. I think that, to me, is the more, you know, that's the thing, if you will, to be really sorry for. Because so many of the other people doped and therefore lied and cheated about it. I guess part of my job was to try to assess, at least on some level, even though it's impossible to look into someone's heart or brain and see the truth, but to at least get a sense or a feeling of for that. Does he mean it? Is it just the same old Lance who's just selling a new story about, you know, redemption, and he wants me and everybody else to buy that story? And I guess that's kind of yes. I became aware of that really quickly.
Do you have an answer to that question? I mean, that
what,
is
you want
it.
Me to answer that? I'm joking. Yes, everyone wants me to answer that question. And everybody that I talk to, and I have plenty of cycling friends, that's all they care about, me answering that question. My own personal opinion, and you know, Lance's enemies, you know, will totally disagree with this, is that his life has really changed now. He is not the Lance of 2005 or 2008 or even 2012. There's a lot more skin in that game now. And by skin, I mean his 18-year-old son, Lucas, who's smart and interesting and who knows everything. His twin 16-year-old daughters, who are smart and know everything. These guys are now, Lance a few years ago wouldn't go near therapy. They're in therapy together with those kids. He's got Anna, the wife who literally married him and then was almost immediately put into this buzzsaw. I think that there's a lot of skin in this game now for him. So if he's just going to be sitting there, you know, pretending to be penitent while secretly harboring all these horrible evil, I just don't see it. I was around the family, and around the kids, and that just seems implausible to me on some level. Now, whether he should be forgiven is different, and I think whether he should be forgiven says more about the person who's saying it than Lance, because, you know, we all know what Lance did. That's not a secret. We all know everything about what he did, and it wasn't very pretty. So whether or not you forgive him, I think says more about you than him. He is who he is, and you can't prove one way or the other that he really does feel sorry. I personally think that he does. But for someone who cannot forgive him, someone like Betsy Andreu or say Kathy Lamont or Greg Lamont, they just can't forgive him, period. And I don't think any amount of him saying or that he's sorry or feeling that he's sorry is ever going to change that. So, again, I think it's who you are.
I'm talking with Sam Gwynn about his article in Outside. It was published, I think, September 15th was the original publication date?
It's the October issue.
The Road Goes On Forever, and the story never ends. It's about Lance Armstrong. So you mentioned Betsy and you mentioned Kathy, and these two families are very different from one another. Number one, Kathy and Greg Lamond have some means.
Right.
And Betsy and Frankie have struggled over these years. And I understand that Lance may feel sorry, but I don't think he's ever actually made amends. He hasn't actually said to them, "I am sorry." Do you think he'll ever get to that point?
Okay, well, see, now we get into the Twilight Zone about that.
That's true.
Is not what Lance says. And actually, that's not what Betsy says either. Lance did call her up and say he was sorry. The problem came after that. The Lamonts sat in this weird meeting, all lawyered up. They were lawyered up. Lance was lawyered up.
Yeah.
And they met and they had this meeting that was when Lance's purpose, he says, was to apologize to them. Now, Kathy, at least, I didn't talk to Greg, I told Kathy at length, but Kathy says that apology did not come in that hours-long meeting with the lawyers present. So it's a little bit different. But Lance says Lance and his lawyer, who they say he did. So we get into this kind of he said, she said thing that I honestly don't know how to resolve. The parties here really don't like each other, and they're never going to reconcile, as far as I can tell. And so it's sort of hard to believe at some point. But put it this way, the apology is not and was not accepted. Whether Lance said something or not is almost irrelevant. Betsy and Frankie and Greg and Kathy don't accept, period. And nor are they ever going to, I don't think. I mean, unless certain things happen, which I don't see happening. And that's just kind of the way it is. And that's a static thing that isn't going to change.
You spent some time with him, with Lance Armstrong, and he, on the one hand, seems fairly happy-go-lucky from some of the things that I read in your article. But on the other hand, he still must have some torture going on somewhere, because he's got this enormous stone called a trial, a $100 million trial coming up in February.
Postponed. Just a little problem, Mary.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah. So if you listen to what Lance says in public, you know, and he's been out in all these various interviews from Joe Rogan to Howard Stern to who knows whom out there. And I mean, he is aware constantly of what he did and the fact that most people still do not forgive him. And he will say that. He'll say, I'm sorry. I said I'm sorry. I really do feel I'm sorry. And I also acknowledge that people do not forgive me and are not going to forgive me, and that I am going to keep apologizing for the rest of my life, acknowledging that most people are not going to forgive me, which is something he says over and over again. So, okay, it's happy-go-lucky. Maybe if you see him playing golf, it looks that way, but there's always that sitting there. On the money side, it's a $100 million liability, potential liability against him. The trial, which I said in my story, was scheduled for November 6th. After the story closed, that changed now to February, and that may change too. But that is the big one, you know. That's the old Floyd Landis whistleblower suit that the government joined, and that is absolutely real liability, potential liability. That's no joke. And that, I mean, if the full, in the worst case scenario, that pretty much wipes out what was once a very large fortune. So, yes, there's lots of financial liability sitting there, and there's lots of personal liability to me in the form of, you know, I asked about his two younger kids. I said, well, what about them? You know, you've been through all this stuff with your two, with your three older kids. So, well, what about the little ones? They don't know what's going on. And so Lance's answer to that is, well, that's in the future. I mean, we have to look forward to, we by me, he, Lance and Anna, to look forward to explaining to them what happened, what their father did. And that is kind of a future. That's a liability that sits out there too. They're going to eventually, they're not old enough to know all that yet. Although the son is old enough to know, people tell him that his father cheated. But so there are all these kind of liabilities sitting there. There's the legal liability. There's that problem with the two younger kids. They haven't even gotten there yet. There's that continuing sense of the world out there not forgiving him for what he did. I mean, it's a, you can look at him in that Aspen house having, you know, his, it's a very social bunch over there. And it looks very happy-go-lucky. But boy, the bottom line is it's not at all.
Yeah, I can imagine. So the last thing I want to ask you, and it's sort of speculation, and that is, do you think this story should just die? Do you think that if we, and this is more along the lines of whether cycling would benefit better by having Lance Armstrong in the rearview mirror and not continually being sort of rehashed. Do you think that cycling would be better off and sport would be better off? Because he does represent sport, not just bicycling.
Right, yes. He's the world's greatest ambassador on both, or the world's worst ambassador.
Right.
That's a really good question, you know, and that's a very big picture question. Is cycling better off? You know, it on some level, it probably is. It's probably better off getting behind that whole era. Getting beyond that whole era. From everything that I kind of sensed doing this story, though, I don't see that happening. It's just people still feel so strongly about it. I can't even account for how strongly. I was sitting there arguing with someone at lunch the other day. I mean, this person was saying, I was defending myself and saying I tried to write a fair story, meaning fair to everybody. And this person was saying, you know, what are you, crazy? He doesn't deserve a fair story. He does not deserve, and you know, loudly, you know, that kind of, can't let that go yet. I shouldn't have even written a fair story. It should have just attacked him and taken him down because that's all that bastard deserves. There's so many of those people out there. I think whether this is your feeling or not, I think probably it is better for cycling, but I don't know. I don't know that people can do that. I don't know that people can let it go. It seems to me, I get a sense that as time goes by, there are more people who can, or there are enough people who think he's been punished enough. And, you know, I tell you the truth, though, let's say there he got a $94 million, I'm just pulling that out of the sky, judgment against him. I don't know, that might change people's minds. People might say, okay, we got him.
Now he's paid his
dues.
Okay,
now he's been taken down all the way, and now we can let it go. I in fact, do know people who think that. But we'll see. But I don't know we don't know what's going to happen with that trial. We don't know what he's going to be left with. And it's possible that he'll get off pretty easily. I think on some level, a lot of the people, you know, who criticize him say, look, the guy's got tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars. Not only that, but he never compensated, let's say, the Andreus for what he did to them, or the Le Mans for that matter, or you know, his former mechanic in Australia, or I don't know, Emma O'Reilly, or people whose reputations he ruined. They put it in financial terms. So you got that going too. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know if it's possible to leave it behind. Lance himself never will be able to.
Yeah, I can imagine. It is him. You know, it's his life.
Yeah, he ain't walking away.
Right, exactly. So my last question to you is, are you going to continue to follow this story?
Yeah, well, you know it. Well, now I am. Now
yeah, it
that
sucked
I'm invested
you in, didn't
in it.
It?
I mean, you know, I had to read all the books on Lance. You know, I had to read a 2-foot-high stack of everything ever written about him. You know, I now got the hard drive loaded up.
I guess.
And you know, I never was able to do that much myself. I don't ride a bike that much, but to me, the Tour de France is one of the absolute most astounding events I have ever even heard of. It is so It is so fast and so violent and so extreme and so absolutely astonishing. I always thought that. So I've always had that opinion about cycling, even though I myself haven't put on the helmet and gone out and done it. So I have a bad knee. That doesn't really work for me. But, yeah, I was always disappointed that I stopped following it after Lance's problems. I guess here in Austin, it was kind of a citywide, you know, furor about this, our local guy here, for so long.
Now you're in knee deep, so that's the way it goes. You're not going to be able to run away. Well, Sam, thank you so much for talking with me. I think the article was fascinating. It certainly created quite a stir in my little tiny world, and it's still happening. Yeah, it really is. Once again, Sam Gwynn, he wrote the article in Outside, which is called The Road Goes On Forever and the Story Never Ends. And it's for the 40th anniversary of Outside Magazine, which I had forgotten that they have a big anniversary this year. Thanks so much for writing the story, and thanks so much for talking with me.
Okay, great talking to you.
All righty. Bye-bye. Sam Gwynn joined me from his office in Austin, Texas. You can find the article, The Road Goes On Forever and the Story Never Ends, in the October issue of Outside Magazine. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to speak with Professor Jason Gill about his work on the benefits of cycling to reduce risks of cardiovascular disease as well as cancer. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back and off to Glasgow, Scotland, to speak with Professor Jason Gill. Hi, Jason. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Diane. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm glad we finally got to catch up. You've been running all over the place with conferences and stuff like that.
Yeah, just keeping out of trouble, keeping busy.
Yeah. Well, that's true. What's going on in Glasgow today?
It's sunny for a change. I mean, it's very much autumn. But, we've got a bit of sun out. So, yes, a good day in Glasgow.
Well, that's a good thing. Well, as a professor of – okay, you need to tell me what cardiometabolic health means.
Okay, so cardiometabolic health is really the sort of interface between cardiovascular disease and heart disease and metabolic disease. So it's things like obesity and diabetes, because these are all linked together. And the things which increase your risk of diabetes and increase your risk of heart disease are in some ways overlap quite a lot. They are being too fast and not doing enough exercise and things related to sleep. So my work really looks at the interface between those and trying to understand the factors which increase risk of developing obesity and cardiovascular disease and diabetes, and how better to use lifestyle to treat those conditions, and also understanding a little bit more about why certain groups of people seem to be at increased risk, and other people in some ways can, if you like, get away with an unhealthy lifestyle but not get ill.
Yeah, that is a good question. That's one of those things that if everybody's exposed to the same thing, why do some people get cancer and some people don't? Or why do some people get diabetes and some people don't? Are you discovering some of these things?
Yeah, one of the things that we find that is really interesting is people from South Asia, so people who are Indian or Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Sri Lankan origin, have about four times the risk of diabetes compared to people from white European ethnic backgrounds. And they seem to develop diabetes at much, much lower body weights, about 10 years earlier in life. And we're trying to understand a little bit about why that is the case. There seems to be differences in the way that South Asians put on body fat compared to Europeans. They appear to put on fat in the more dangerous places, so visceral fat and ectopic fat, so fat around the liver maybe a little bit more. And there's also potentially differences in the way that their muscle works. We've got data to suggest that South Asians' muscles are a little bit less good at burning fat than Europeans' muscles, and that seems to be associated with increased risk. So we're trying to understand a little bit more about why that's the case, to try and help develop new, different interventions to help prevent diabetes in South Asians, because the interventions we have at the moment work less well in South Asians than white Europeans.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, I want to talk about an article that was published back in April, and I hope I get your colleague's name right. Dr. Carlos Silis, is it?
Carlos Celis Morales. Yeah, he's an excellent postdoctoral research associate who's originally from Chile, and he's been in the UK for about the last 10 years or so.
Well, you published an article in April about research that you're doing that shows a marked decrease in the mortality rate for those who bicycle to work. Yay. So how did you first stumble on this topic? How did this become interesting to you?
Yeah, so we've known for a number of years that a high level of physical activity is protective against cardiovascular disease and diabetes and dying from any cause. But one of the issues is that we know that physical activity is good for us, but a large proportion of the population aren't physically active enough. And one of the reasons that people often cite for not being active enough is they don't have time. It's hard to go to the gym. So what we wanted to do is look at active commuting, which is a way of building your activity into the day, and seeing whether, well, if you do that, you're more likely to get your activity in because you have to go to work or you have to go to the shops. And if you can get your activity in the same way, you're killing two birds with one stone. We wanted to actually quantify what the extent of benefit might be for people who actively commute. So we looked at the associations between different forms of commuting and risk of dying from any cause, dying from cancer, dying from cardiovascular disease, and also developing cancer and developing cardiovascular disease.
The number of people in the study is mind-boggling. It's almost 250,000. And so it has something to do with the UK Biobank. What is that, and how is that involved in your study? Where did you get these people?
The UK Biobank is a fantastic resource. It's the biggest or one of the biggest ever epidemiological studies done. And what happened was between 2007 and 2010-ish, I can't remember the exact years, about 500,000 people were recruited from across 22 centres in the UK, and they had a whole host of measurements made on them at baseline. And then because in the UK we have a single health system and people's data follow-up can be electronically followed, so we can know from each of these people what happened to them every time they went into hospital, visited their GP, whether they developed a disease. So what we can do is follow these people up forever. So what happened at baseline is one of the questions that was asked is how do you get to work? And you had an option of non-active forms of transport, whether you cycle to work, walk to work, or did a combination of all of them. So what we did is we looked at people's routes, way they went to work, and then followed them up for 5 years at the time of the paper and essentially counted up the number of people who developed heart disease, developed cancer, and died, and compared the groups with the different forms of getting to work and tried to see whether there was a difference.
And there was a remarkable difference.
Yeah, so what we found is people who cycle to work had about a 40% lower risk of death from any cause, from cardiovascular disease and of cancer. And one of the key things that we did is we tried to adjust for what we call confounding factors. So it might be that the sort of person that cycles to work had a generally healthier type of lifestyle. They might smoke less, they might eat better, they might drink less alcohol. So what we try to do is adjust for all these other factors. We can statistically look at these factors and try and factor them out of the analysis to try and see what was the effect of cycling alone once you've taken all these factors into account. And this 40% lower risk was after we took into account all these other factors. So it was quite a substantial reduction in risk.
I guess. I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Jason Gill. He is from the University of Glasgow in Scotland. And he and it's Carlos Celis Morales.
Carlos Celis Morales.
Carlos Celis Morales did this study that was published back in April. So you have more data now than you had at the time the study was published. Is it still running true? Are you still seeing?
Yes, it's fine. Sorry, I spoke over you. So we published data with 5 years of follow-up. There's since been another release of data to 7 years of follow-up. We haven't published it, but the results are consistent. So the association is still remaining with a longer follow-up, and we can keep revisiting in the future as more and more data become available and time goes on.
Is there a specific demographic in this study, or is it men, women, all ages, all backgrounds?
So UK Biobank was people aged 40 to 70 at baseline.
Okay.
The mean age was 52.6 years at baseline, but it was a range from 40 to 70. And there were about half men and half women. So in our 264,000, there were 52% women. So we have an even split between men and women, and they're sort of middle-aged to older. So that's exactly the population that we're interested in, because these are the populations that actually develop these diseases and conditions. If we studied a much younger population, we probably wouldn't see anything, because basically when you're 25, you can almost do anything and nothing bad's going to happen to you. But as you get older, your lifestyle seems to sort of catch up with you a little bit more.
You compared cyclists who commuted and people who walked to work and found that cycling was still better.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So we tried to understand a little bit more about, well, there was benefit with walking, but cycling seemed to have a bigger benefit. And what we think is going on is a couple of things. One is we know cycling is a higher intensity activity than walking. You get more out of breath cycling. We know from lots of other studies that the intensity of exercise is associated with the degree of benefit. So that's one factor. The other is the people who cycled tended to do more than the people that walked. So the people that walked to work on average walked about 6 miles per week. And the people who cycled to work cycled on average 30 miles per week to work. And even taking into account the fact that you cycle faster than you walk, they would have had a much longer duration of time cycling than walking. And we know from, again, a number of other studies that the total volume of activity you do gives you a bigger benefit when you do more. So we think it's a combination of cycling's a bit harder and the cyclist did a little bit more. What we also found is we divided people into short cyclists and long cyclists. So short cyclists were people that did less than 30 miles per week, long more than 30 miles per week. And we saw what we call a dose-response relationship. So the people that did more cycling saw a bigger benefit than the people that did less.
Wow. So everybody who listens is going, see, this is why I like to ride long distances. So I want to ask you about something that I found even more interesting. Heart disease made perfect sense to me. But you also saw a drop in cancer rates and overall mortality. What do you think's going on there?
Okay, so most people die from cancer or cardiovascular disease. If you put those two together, you will get the majority of deaths. So a drop in cardiovascular disease would normally be associated with a drop in all-cause mortality. So that's fine. With cancer, it's more interesting. The data are less clear with cancer, but the evidence that is there does suggest that physical activity is associated with a lower risk of cancer. The evidence and the mechanisms underpinning it are less well studied than they are for cardiovascular disease. But we know, for example, that being less fat is associated with a lower risk. And although we adjusted for body mass index, you might have differences in body composition. So cyclists might be a bit leaner, even if they don't weigh less than the non-cyclists. And there's other mechanisms related to inflammation. Physical activity might have a slight anti-inflammatory effect. And we know that cancer is a disease which is associated with increased inflammation. So there's a number of different mechanisms which are biologically plausible, which might explain the association between cycling and cancer. But it is less well studied than the association with cardiovascular disease.
So are you a cyclist?
Oh, I am, yes, definitely.
Oh, good.
I used to compete in triathlon. So I know cyclists don't think that's really cycling, but I used to compete in triathlon. I did Ironman triathlons. I went to world championships and stuff a long, long time ago when I was a much, much younger person. And I cycled to work.
You don't look like an old person now.
Well, I'm an older person than I was 20 years ago.
Aren't we all?
I cycle to work. I cycle. It's about some 13 miles to work for me. I was trying to do it every day, but I kind of get a bit tired when I do it every day. So I probably try and get in 2 or 3 days a week cycling both ways. And I think that's really good. It actually is about as quick as going in by car. So you don't really have a time penalty with cycling. It's a bit of traffic on the way into work if I drive. So I cycle into work.
I'd like to offer my listeners the opportunity to read your study. Where can they find it?
So it's in the British Medical Journal, or BMJ, and all BMJ articles are open access. So if you go to the BMJ website, and I guess if you just type in my name, Jason Gill, as a keyword, or cycle commuting, you should be able to get the paper come up. You have a website associated with your podcast, but I can send you the link that people could click on it if that would be helpful.
By all means, we'll put it on our Facebook page. Absolutely. And we also have a website. Yes. So, you know, you and I have exchanged emails. So sure, send me the link and we'll distribute it. Are you working on any other studies that include cycling?
So we're doing a lot of studies on UK Biobank. So it's a fantastic resource. It's so rich, and because the number of people is so large, it enables us to answer questions that we haven't really been able to answer quite so well before because we didn't have the statistical power. So we're doing lots of studies on UK Biobank. Lots of them involve physical activity and cycling as a part of that. We're hopefully going to follow up on this particular study in a few years' time with a sort of a part two when we've had a few more years of follow-up. So, yeah, we're doing lots of work looking at cycling and physical activity in general.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for talking with us. Everybody's going to say, I'm going to commute to work, I hope. We live in Northeast Ohio, so we have some nasty winters.
I just want to finish up. One point I forgot to mention.
Oh, sure.
I think it's a really, really important point. It's one of the things we looked at was something called mixed mode commuting. So cycle commuting is probably available for most for people who live generally in a 10-mile radius of work, I guess. So if you live 25 miles away from work, you're probably not able to cycle all the way unless you're really, really hardcore. But what we did is look at something called mixed mode commuting. So that's where people would take the car or train or bus part of the way and cycle or walk the other part of the way. And so what we found is people who did mixed mode commuting with the active component being cycling also had a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease and mortality. So what we saw is benefits with mixed mode commuting. So that means that cycle commuting is open potentially, and you get the benefits for people who live anywhere. So what you could do is take your car or take your train part of the way and do the last bit on a bike, and you seem to get the benefit. So it's not just people who live close enough to work to be able to cycle all the way that get the benefit. So what I'd like to see is things like park and cycle, or in the UK, I don't know whether you've got this in the US yet, but they've got these city hire bikes where basically you have an app and you can unlock the bikes and you can just take them and take them to your destination. So if we see things like that around train stations or car parks at the edge of cities, what you can do is people can get the benefit of doing the last few miles on the bike, and it opens up the possibility of cycle commuting to just about anybody.
All of our buses accommodate bikes on the front. You can put your bike on the front of the bus and jump on the bus. I think some of our trains do. All of the Amtrak trains now allow cycling. And we do have bike share in a lot of our big cities. What was the average commute? Did it matter what the commute was? That was a question I meant to ask earlier on, and I didn't.
The average commute. So in terms of distance, what we did is we looked at the average weekly distance, which was 30 miles per week.
You did say that.
And we took people longer and shorter. So I guess if they did it every day, it would be 6 miles total.
Right.
So on average, people were, if they went to work every day, cycling about 3 miles each way.
Yeah, you did say that. Well, this has just been fascinating, and I'm really excited that the study came out the way it did because it, you know, gives people the opportunity. One of the things people want to do here is sort of petition their employers to say, I want to bring my bike to work, or I want to, you know, you need a place to put it once you get there. And a lot of employers, I mean, 3 miles or 6 miles, you don't need a shower, but you need a safe place for your bike.
Fantastic. Yeah, and the other thing that I think is important is that when we were invited down to speak to the Department for Transport in the UK after the study, because one of the things that we really need to do is a lot of people don't ride bikes that might ride bikes if the infrastructure was better.
Yeah, no kidding.
Things like bike lanes. So I think this sort of work actually helps potentially people with advocacy say, well, look, we need to try and get more people to cycle because that will improve health. It will reduce healthcare costs and all these associated other benefits. And we don't know. We need to do the studies, but it could well influence productivity as well. But if we need to make it easier for people to cycle, because in, say, the Netherlands or in Denmark, people just cycle. They don't consider themselves cyclists. It's just that's how people get around town. And that's because the infrastructure is set up
right
to make cycling the easiest thing to do. And I guess in the US and in the UK, a lot of our cities aren't set up in that way. We're getting a little bit better. There are more bike lanes being built. But if we can do that and make it easier for the person who's maybe a bit scared of traffic to ride their bike, then I think that will be a fantastic situation that will improve public health, reduce pollution, reduce congestion. So it's a, I think it's a win-win-win if we can do that.
And there are many, many bicycle advocacy organizations here in the U.S. that are trying to do that. And we are seeing some changes. It's an uphill battle in a lot of places, though. So yeah, we'll just keep plugging away.
Do you know what? What gives me optimism is how quickly things can change when you get a tipping point. I mean, there's no smoking in workplaces and pubs and things like that. I mean, I remember when I was younger, people were allowed to smoke on aeroplanes. And now it's just been a complete change in not very many years where it's completely sort of unacceptable for people to smoke in a lot of places where people were completely allowed to smoke before. And public sentiment has changed very quickly. So if we can reach a tipping point, it might become something where basically people riding bikes, and that's just what you do once you get the infrastructure and enough people doing that. I'm hopeful that we might see a change in years rather than decades.
Yeah, me too. Well, Jason, thank you so much for talking with me. This was a lot of fun, and I think it's a really important topic, and I'm glad you're doing the research. It's going to make us all much better off.
Okay, thanks, Diana. I really enjoyed this session. Take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jason Gill joined me from his office at Glasgow University. What an interesting guy. You can find the article at the BMJ. It's the British Medical Journal. If you just look up bicycle commuting at thebmj.com, you'll find it. Let's take a short break, and then I'll be right back to speak with Sue Knopp about her new book, Bike Hunt, and the meaning behind it. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Hi, Sue. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure. I just finished reading the final page of your book before I left for the studio to record our conversation today.
Oh, wonderful. And what did you think?
Oh, my goodness. Your story, it like needs to be a movie.
Really?
Wouldn't that be cool? You know, like a documentary. It's so interesting and it's so rich with just so much feeling. I know that you worked a long time and you put it down and you went back to it and you changed your perspective. I don't want to give a lot of it away, but you have led an unbelievable life. The book is remarkable.
Thank you very much. No, it was an arduous 10-year journey writing this book.
Well, I think it was worth the effort. So can we start at the beginning and without giving it all away? Because I think I want to give so much away that people don't want to read it, because I'm telling you, it's really, really good. It's a page turner, one of those page turners. Tell us how you began your journey into advocacy, because that started when you were really, really young.
Yes, very, very young. Fortunately, I had a grandmother who was an activist back in California, in Mill Valley, in fact. She had started the tennis club. She had started the local Humane Society, one of the founders. And so, in fact, she got me my first advocacy job as a volunteer at that Humane Society. And that one led to other animal rights jobs. And the animal rights jobs led to river preservation jobs. And all of that's in the book. But, yeah, by the time I got to Thunderhead, I'd probably worked at least a dozen, if not more, nonprofits in various fields, from animal rights to environment to disabled advocacy and all of it.
Well, you know, it seems like as a young woman, you were absolutely fearless. You were doing things like guiding river trips. You were hitchhiking, traveling all over the world. I don't know where you got the guts to do some of these things.
Well, I can credit my abusive father and my abusive brother. I think sometimes people get stuck in abusive relationships, which is what happened to me at Thunderhead later. But for some reason, as a child, I was much wiser than I was as an adult. And I recognized the abuse from these two. I recognized that home was not safe. And I first actually escaped that environment by bicycle. So I was biking around, you know, Marin County on my own. And then I discovered my thumb. And by discovering my thumb, I could hitchhike anywhere in the world, and that just opened up everything. So everything I discovered and ran into on my world travels, even if it was a little scary, was nothing compared to the fear I had at home. So in a way, I have to give credit to my father and my brother for making the home environment so dangerous and unsafe that anything I encountered in the world was like, whatever, this is great. So yeah, I was fearless.
Yeah, you really were.
Yeah.
Let's talk a moment about the Thunderhead Alliance. I remember the first time I heard the two words, Thunderhead Alliance, put together. I knew it was an advocacy organization, but I really didn't know much about it. Tell us what it was and how you became involved with them.
Yeah, and even enamored, I should say. When I first heard about them, I was the executive director of the local bicycle and pedestrian advocacy organization here in Prescott, Arizona, Prescott Alternative Transportation. I'd helped found it. You know, I was the executive director. And I heard about this national coalition of groups like PAT, Prescott Alternative Transportation. The mission was creating, strengthening, and uniting state and local bicycle advocacy organizations. It was like, wow. So, you know, PAT was small. And, you know, we're just in a sort of a small city here in the middle of Arizona. Wow, I thought, you know, we could learn from, you know, all these other bike organizations all over the country. Well, I tried and tried and tried to join Thunderhead, and they wouldn't accept PAT. They would ignore the messages and all of that. Finally, I asked the director of another organization that was a member of Thunderhead, well, how much do you pay for dues? And I think they said $100 or something. So I just sent $100 to the Thunderhead Alliance, hoping they would cash the check, and I could say, okay, now we're members, and that's what they did.
Oh, no kidding.
It was really strange. It was, you know, very elitist before I got really involved in them. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to break when I did get the job as the Thunderhead executive director. That was the number one thing I wanted to break, was that elitism.
Yeah, and it almost broke you. So I want to talk about the work that you were doing a little bit, because it included a lot of travel. And pretty much everywhere you went, you stayed in hostels, so you didn't spend a lot of money. And you would find a used bike instead of taking any other means of transportation. So the title of the book is Bike Hunt. And I thought that this concept was just brilliant. Tell us about Bike Hunt, what it is, how it works, and what you learn from it.
The title, I have to say, though, is meant to encompass the entire story, too, because even though that book includes these wonderful bike hunts, and I'll tell you about that in a second, I feel like for that the entire span of the book, I was still hunting for how can I, you know, help the world with bicycles. And you'll see at the end, you know, whether or not I did that. But the bike hunts themselves definitely contributed to the title. And what it was, I was so frustrated in my job at the Thunderhead Alliance because I could not get the support for these great ideas I had. I mean, just huge, significant impact I thought we could make by supporting local and state, you know, bike organizations. If each of these organizations could thrive, what impact we would have all across North America. Well, I would start in on these programs, and the board, my board at Thunderhead didn't get it. We can talk more about that, but it was just frustrating, so frustrating. And then also, you know, you read in the book what some of the other strange things I ran into. Well, in order to keep my sanity, and this is probably one of the reasons I stayed to the bitter end and or could survive it, when I traveled, and because I'm a bike mechanic, I could go and get a used bike and ride it for the, you know, for that conference, you know, for the whole time I was in that far-off city. And then at the end, I would give it away. in the book, you know, it shows how I sort of developed that idea. I not only developed the idea, I started obsessing about the idea. So every time there was another conference or another training or something, the first thing that would come to mind is like, oh, yeah, I can do another PyCons. It wasn't until afterwards and when I was writing the book, I realized how obsessive I had become about those PyCons. And I created rules, rules I had to follow, including as soon as I arrived and, you know, got settled, the first person I asked where I could get a used bike, I had to follow their instructions to the end, no matter how insane they were. And I did. And it's, and some of the stories just hunting for the bikes are hilarious because of that rule. I don't know. You read the other rules, too. What did you find interesting about that obsession I had?
Well, the endings of every bike hunt was you had to give the bike away. So for some of the people who ended up with these bikes, it was really interesting how you chose them, how you watched the people, where you went. Just the bike hunt, the process of the bike hunt is so clever and so compelling. I really liked it. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sue Knopp. She is the executive director of OneStreet.org, and her book, Bike Hunt, is just out. It is an excellent book. It's an interesting study in a sort of a psychological mystery almost. It's
yes.
Just fascinating. Talk about your devotion to the Thunderhead Alliance. You went headlong and in a relentless way, even though you knew they were almost sabotaging you all the time. What happened?
Yeah, what happened? It's something that I'm still trying to figure out. Number one is that all my previous experience in nonprofits, not only nonprofits, but as a bike messenger, as a farm worker, as a commercial fishing worker, everywhere I'd worked in groups, when I put the labor in, when I put the time in and I went above and beyond, I was looking around at a team that was doing the same thing. We did that together. We shared a vision together, whether it was getting as many crabs as we could on the boat or whether it was making sure that these disabled people were having the best dang time they could on a river trip. We were working together, and I just put my head down, work as hard as I could. Every time I looked up, my team members were doing the same thing. So it was really bizarre to me to be at the Thunderhead Alliance working my butt off, and then I'd get on these board calls and, you know, or I'd ask, you know, folks to help, and they wouldn't. But I can't say that happened immediately. It was a very slow change that happened over the 5.5 years. The first board was very supportive, and I got them on committees, and they were helping. Not as much as, you know, I had experienced in other nonprofits, but just slowly eroded. And maybe it was a bit of that sort of how to boil a frog. This is a horrible thing, but if you put a frog in cold water and you turn up the heat really...
Right. It doesn't know it's getting boiled. It
yeah,
doesn't know.
The frog won't jump out.
Right.
And I never jumped out. It just got worse, worse, and worse. But also, there was that factor. And then it was just this ambition I had. Maybe it was the time of my life, you know, that sort of career, mid-career time of my life, you know, where I thought, you know, this is it. This is my dream job. This is where I'm going to change the world, you know, because I can work really hard in this great organization with this mission of creating, strengthening, and uniting state and local bike organizations. My God, that doesn't get any better than that. I just figured, I'm going to put everything into this, and let's go. Let's make this happen. Boy, I was out, you know, ahead, and nobody was following me, except I can say the state and the leaders of the state and local organizations were. And, oh, my God, they were just wonderful, you know, and inspiring. But they were the members of Thunderhead. They were the ones we were, you know, supposed to be helping and serving, and, you know, that was the positive of that job, was interacting directly with those leaders of the organizations, those members, and seeing so many great things happening because of my effort. But I just didn't have the support with my team, you know, like I'd seen in the other organizations and jobs I'd had before.
Well, some of the places you were able to travel, both for Thunderhead Alliance and in the time you took after and maybe before sometimes, were just remarkable. You always would get a bike. You had a sort of surrogate family in Sweden, was it?
Yes.
In Sweden, you still do, that's right, where you travel. But Thunderhead Alliance disappeared after they fired you.
Yep.
So how is advocacy today? I feel like it hasn't gotten anywhere.
I'm glad you've asked that question. The answer is very disturbing. And, of course, I don't have the answer, but it's just the whole topic is very disturbing. What I experienced at Thunderhead was a very small segment of this, I like to refer to it as a disease, in the U.S. bike movement. It's like we're all trying to consume each other. Who's the most powerful? Who's going to charge ahead and be the one who gets to Congress first or makes this speech or tells everybody they're the greatest? When, you know, did you go to Interbike this year, Diane?
I did not. I have not been to Interbike in several years.
Okay, it was a ghost town.
That's what I hear.
It was all but empty. They had to fill spaces with tables and chairs, and the aisles were at least twice as wide, and there weren't very many people.
I think that's indicative of the entire bicycle industry, from advocacy all the way through retail and then to manufacturing. It's
in the U.S. We have to say
yes.
U.S.
No, you're right.
Thriving.
You're right.
Going nuts, even Africa and some of the Asian networks are going crazy.
True.
U.S. is undermining itself, is consuming itself. And I don't know if you've noticed, but the national U.S. advocacy effort is now led by industry executives.
Right.
And those industry executives are trying to compete with each other.
Right.
And then that competition is now getting into advocacy, and so which organization is going to consume which organization? And it's competition rather than impact. You know, who's the better one, rather than, hey, let's, like that team effort I described, or, hey, let's work together, let's put our heads down and go at this vision, this collective vision. No, it's, I'm doing it. You're not allowed to do it because I'm doing it. I'm the better one, or my organization is the one that's doing it. Yeah.
Well, I know that a few years ago when I went to the Bike Summit, it was very effective. And then Andy left, and I don't know anything about the Bike Summit other than, or about the LAB, other than it has lost a couple of directors in the meantime. It just seems like it's so fractured and so fragmented and so fraught with issues. I just, from, as I said, as a retailer for many years, and you were a retailer for many years.
Yeah,
that's,
15 years, yeah.
Yeah, that, that segment is also floundering. It's very disconcerting for somebody who's been in the industry over 40 years to watch it sort of in its disheveled state. Maybe it'll get to a place where it'll start rebuilding itself. I don't know.
Well, that's part of what I write in the book about, you know, the Lucifer effect and how human beings are inclined to behave badly. We can't just sit back and say, oh, well, this is strange. You know, this bad behavior is strange. It will probably change. No, human beings are inclined to behave this way. And in order to break that system, that system of consumption, of crushing each other, we actually have to step up and stop it proactively.
Unfortunately, we don't have a whole lot of time. I encourage my listeners that if they're interested in the topic of advocacy, and if you're interested in Sue's story, which is just, it's just riveting, that you can go to onestreet.org, which is your nonprofit organization. It's yes. onestreet.org. Tell us what it does and how it's different from other organizations that you've been involved with over the years.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I founded One Street immediately after being fired from the Thunderhead Alliance. They fired me without cause, and like you said, you know, it went away after that. My immediate reaction to that severing was to found this international organization called One Street, with the entire basis of it set on kindness and respect and service to bicycle organizations.
Where can people get a copy of Bike Hunt, your book?
Okay, it's up on all online vendors, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, all those and other ones around the world. Bookstores can order it, and also at onestreet.org.
And it's also available not only in paperback, which is what I have. My copy is a paperback, but you can get it as an e-book too, right?
Yes, only on Kindle right now, but okay. Later in the year, it'll be on others as well.
All right. Well, Sue, thanks so much for talking with me. If you'd like to hear the rest of my conversation with Sue, we are going to continue it. We don't have time on air to do that tonight, but we are going to continue it. I want to hear more about the idea of this Lucifer effect and how it related to Sue's role in the Thunderhead Alliance, and a little bit more about Bike Hunt. So you can go to OutspokenCyclist.com and download the second part of the podcast. Sue, thanks so much for joining me today, and we will continue when the show ends.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
My pleasure. Sue Knapp joined me from her home in Prescott, Arizona. You can get a copy of Bike Hunt at onestreet.org. As I said at the beginning of the show, not only did I thoroughly enjoy this book, Sue and I got to talking, and so there is a longer version of this conversation that I had with her. You can go to OutspokenCyclist.com and look under Extra Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please remember you can always follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Stitcher, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. I'll be back next week with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. And in the meantime, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.